Okay, we're in Ecclesiastes chapter 7. See if you can find that while the lights are coming on. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Don't you like the festive atmosphere in here this tonight? Huh? Good job, girl. Okay, Ecclesiastes 7. Interesting book. Every time I read through Ecclesiastes, there's stuff in there that you just struggle with. You go, where's this guy coming from? But I was thinking as I was driving in tonight, I was thinking, you know, really the more and more I spend time in Ecclesiastes, it's a book of an old man. It's a book of a guy who's learned a lot of lessons. And I think the reason I struggle with it is because I haven't been old enough to have learned all those lessons yet. I don't know if that makes sense. But I think the older I get, I'm starting to get some of it. I think last year when we went through the book of Job Job's the same kind of a book where I've always hated going through the book of Job. And yet when we went through it as a church, seeing the great blessings and getting a different idea about trials and difficulties. Well, there's some of that in here in Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 1, first 14 verses, talking about what's better, about wisdom making life better. Verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. In other words, it's better to be a better person than a richer person. It's better to have a good name than to have lots of money. A good name is better than precious ointment. Now he's going to talk about how you get better through the rest of the section. So you want to be careful with some of these verses, not to just cut them into little snippets and say, okay, we're done with that verse. Next, you know, move on to the next verse because there's a lot of connections with this stuff. And he says the day of death is better than the day of one's birth, and we'll see as we get into this why. He says the day of your death is better than the day of your birth. But I was kind of thinking, just really kind of far out there stuff. I was thinking the day of Jesus' death is much better than the day of his birth. And I'm really glad I know we all complain about the commercialism of Christmas, but, you know, as you were praying, you know, this is a chance to talk about Jesus. So we can take it, you know. No reason we can't take it, you know. The world doesn't have a clue. The world thinks it's all about reindeers and snowmen and all this kind of silliness stuff, you know. It's not about Rudolph or Frosty. We're supposed to be remembering the birth of Jesus. And even though, you know, maybe he wasn't born December 25th, don't get hung up on that. It's just a chance to talk about Jesus. But the day of his death was better than the day of his birth. It was. Aren't we so glad that for the day of his death as opposed to the day of his birth? Verse 2. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Funerals are better than birthday parties. Right? Right? Not on your life. This guy is sicko. This guy's a sicko, right? I mean, let's take a vote, okay? Tonight after church is over, there's a birthday party in that room and we're having a funeral over there. Which room are you going to go to, huh? Yeah, I don't know either, Josh. Yeah. Yeah, some of you are thinking, I wish it was my funeral. I just finished with his life, you know. But no, don't go there. Do we think that? No. He says, it's better to go to the house of mourning than to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. Funerals have a great value because they sober you up like nothing else. You know, and the more tragic, the more sobering. You know, I guess it's funny. I have a different slant on funerals now that I'm a professional funeral guy. You know, I I do this. This is one of the jobs, part of a pastor's job description is to do funerals. I don't do a lot of them. We don't, you know, some churches have a bunch more older people that die more and all that kind of stuff, and we just don't have that. But you know, I've done a couple dozen funerals, you know, and at first you just kind of like don't want to be there. But you see things a whole lot differently. We do our best in our society to avoid death. When people are dying, what do? We put them away somewhere. We put them in a hospital. We put them out of touch. We get them away from the limelight. And yet that's not what God's desire is. Moses said in Psalm 90, verse 12, he said, "So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom." God, help us to realize, you know, to take each day as precious. In Luke 12, let me read to you something from Luke 12, verses 13 to 21. Then someone called from the crowd, "Teacher, please tell my brother to divide our father's estate with me." Jesus replied, "Friend, who made me a judge over you to decide such things as that?" Then he said, "Beware, don't be greedy for what you don't have. Real life is not measured by how much we own." And he gave an illustration. A rich man had a fertile farm that produced fine crops. In fact, his barns were full to overflowing. So he said, "I know, I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. Then I'll have room enough to store everything. And I'll sit back and say to myself, my friend, you have enough stored away for years to come. Now take it easy, eat, drink, and be merry." But God said to him, "You fool, you will die this very night. Then who will get it all? Yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth, but not to have a rich relationship with God." We need to be ready for the day of our death. Because like it or not, it's coming. Like it or not, it's coming. I was talking with a family up at the front door after one of the services Sunday, and they were sharing with me the matriarch of the family has been having a tough month. She's lost 3 close family members in the last 2 weeks. It's been real, real rough. And we all think of stuff like that. We go, oh my gosh, how could somebody survive so much loss? Gang, everybody you know is going to die. You know? We don't think that way. We don't think about the fact that everybody, but that's the truth. Oh, aren't you just glad you came to church tonight? We're talking about, you know, death and tax. Now, I'll talk about taxes next, you know, or something, you know. But gang, it is inevitable. And Solomon's saying, look, we need to get ready for this. We need to get ready for this. Are you ready to face death? A woman finds herself outside the pearly gates where St. Peter greets her. "Am I where I think I am?" she exclaims. "It's so beautiful. Did I really make it to heaven?" St. Peter replies, "Yes, my dear, these are the gates to heaven. But you must do one thing before you can enter." Very excited, the woman asks what she must do to pass through the gates. "Spell a word," St. Peter replies. "Well, what word?" she asks. "Any word," answers St. Peter. "It's your choice." The woman promptly replies, "The word I will spell is love. L-O-V-E. St. Peter congratulates her on her good fortune in making it into heaven and asks her if she will take his place at the gates for a moment while he runs an errand. "Oh, I'd be honored," she says, "but what should I do if someone comes while you're gone?" St. Peter instructs her to require any newcomers to spell a word just as she had done. So the woman takes St. Peter's chair, watches the beautiful angel soaring around her, and lo and behold, a man approaches the gates. It's her husband. "What happened?" she cries. "Why are you here?" Her husband explains, "I was so upset when I left your funeral that I got into an automobile accident. Now I'm here ready to join you in heaven." "Well, not just yet," the woman replies. "First you must spell a word." "Well, what word?" he asks. "Czechoslovakia." You know what? To be perfectly honest, when you die, you will not stand in front of St. Peter. We have lots of jokes. I got tons of jokes about St. Peter at the gates, types of jokes. You're not going to stand before St. Peter. Misconception. Wrong. You're going to stand before God. The Bible says in Hebrews 9:27, it is appointed unto man once to die, and then comes judgment. You will be judged. You will be judged by God. And the judgment isn't a spelling test. The judgment, often if you ask people, well, are you going to go to heaven? Almost everybody will say yes. Not too many people will say, well, I'm not. You know, everybody kind of has their idea they're going to go to heaven. But you ask them why. The common thing is, well, I'm pretty good. You weigh it all out, I've got more good stuff than bad stuff. God doesn't do it that way. It's not a balance. It's not a balanced scale. It's not, do you have more good than bad? It's about, are you perfect? It's God's standard. God's standard is perfection. And see, the problem is, you and I, the whole world, has a big problem. We're not perfect. We are sinful. And our sin keeps us from God. And unless you deal with the sin, you will not be in heaven. You have to deal with the sin. You don't deal with the sin by being good enough, by helping enough old ladies across the street, or by selling Girl Scout cookies. You deal with the sin by paying the price. And the price is death. The Bible says the wages of sin is death. And so you have a choice. If you want to pay that price, that means you die and go to hell. And then your sins are paid for. But you spend eternity in hell. Well, that doesn't sound like much fun. That's why God sent Jesus. It's better that the day he died than the day he was born. Because on the day he died to pay for our sins. And that's the issue. It's not what have you done, it's who you know. Do you know somebody who's going to pay the price for you? Are you ready? Are you ready? If you had a heart attack in the next 2 minutes, and that's it. We call the paramedics and they get here and they say, oh, it's too late. He's already gone. She's already gone. Do you know where you'd spend eternity? It doesn't have to be a gamble. It doesn't have to be, well, I hope so. No, it can be I know so. God wants you to know that you have eternal life. And it's whether you know Jesus. It's whether you're trusting in him. That's it, gang. That's it. And that's why it's better to go to a funeral than it is to a birthday party, because it wises us up and gets us ready for heaven. God wants you to be there. That's the important thing. God doesn't want to keep you out of heaven. Well, how come God has this standard of perfection? Well, it's not because he wants to keep you out. No, God has done everything that's necessary to get you into heaven. Let's move on. Verse 3. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. There he goes. He's a real depressed guy. Sorrow is better than laughter. Another translation says, for sadness has a refining influence on us. Our hearts get stronger through difficult times. Verse 4, the heart of the wise is in the house of the mourning. Is it in the house of mourning? But the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Again, the same idea as verse 2. Verse 5. It is better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. A fool may try and make you feel better by trying to cheer you up and tell you silly jokes. A wise person will make you better. It doesn't make you feel better. They will make you better, even if it has to come with a loving rebuke. That's the idea of verse 5 or 6. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of the fool. This also is vanity. In other words, fool just makes a lot of noise. Verse 7, surely oppression maketh a wise man mad, and a gift or a bribe destroyeth the heart. Allowing yourself to give into a bribe weakens your heart. Verse 8, better is the end of a thing than the beginning thereof, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. That last part, The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. I was thinking about that. You know, proud people are impatient. Why? Why are proud people impatient? What's the thinking? Yeah. They're good. They're too good to wait. You know, I shouldn't have to wait. You know, so I should get it now. You know, I'm just thinking about myself. It's better to be humble and to be patient. And when I think about it, when I'm impatient about something, what's that saying about me? Am I the proud or the humble? Verse 9. Be not hasty in thy spirit to be angry, for anger resteth in the bosom of fools. Here's another great one. So don't be a person with a short temper. And if you've got anger resting in your heart, for anger resteth in the bosom of... So if I got anger resting in my heart, if I got a grudge against somebody, what does it say about me? Fool. Verse 10. Say not thou what is the cause that the former days were... What is the cause that the former days were better than these? For thou dost not inquire wisely concerning this. In other words, it's not a wise thing to look back and wish for the good old days. He says, how come the good old days were so... How come life was so much better before than this? He says, you're not doing a wise thing in asking about this. Good old days are not necessarily better days. You know, I like to think about good old days when certain troubles did not exist and, you know, certain anxieties and worries weren't around. When I look back to the bad old days that have happened, I think, oh, I'd never want to go through those again. But the bad old days have been the things that have helped me grow up a little bit more. Haven't they? Yeah, that's right, Rich. The bad old days did help you grow up a little bit more. Think about it. Did you grow from the bad stuff? Did you grow? And then we sit around and just talk about the bad old days. Let's go out for coffee and, Craig, let's go out and talk about the bad old days. Oh, boy. Verse 11. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, and by it there is profit to them that see the sun. In other words, it's nice to get a big inheritance, but it's even nicer that when you get a big inheritance that you have the wisdom to deal with it correctly, deal with it wisely. It's even better. Verse 12. For wisdom is a defense, and money is a defense, but the excellency of knowledge is that wisdom giveth life to them that have it. In other words, money and wisdom both protect you. They're both a defense for you. But wisdom's a little better because wisdom can actually prolong your life. Money doesn't necessarily prolong your life. Verse 13, consider the work of God. For who can make straight that which he hath made crooked? Consider the work of God. For who can make straight, who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? Sometimes God makes things crooked. Sometimes God makes things that we look at and think are not right or not perfect. When God called Moses to be his spokesman and to go to set the Israelites free from Egypt, Moses said, came up with all kinds of excuses. And one of them was, well, I can't talk very good. I stutter. You know, that's all, folks. You know, he was before Porky Pig. There was Moses. And, I'm not good in front of talking in front of people. And God said to him, look, buddy, who made the blind eye? Who made the deaf ear? The implication is God makes those things. And the implication is, buddy, don't question If I've asked you to do something, you might not think you're equipped for it, but I've made you the way that you are. Here it says, consider the work of God. Who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? You're going to have a hard time if you feel like you need to fix the things that God has done. Maybe even the way he's made you. That's something that's very common. We often I'll bet most of us don't look in the mirror and go, "My, what a handsome devil I am." Do you? Do you do that? I bet probably not a one of us in here. Those people don't go to our church. I'll bet you. You know, there's probably most of us look in the mirror and we think, "Oh my, I'm gonna get rid of this thing," you know, and my nose was only a little bit smaller, you know, or so whatever it is. Who's to say God didn't make you just the way he wanted? I'm not saying that it's bad that you want to, you know, take care of yourself and improve your appearance and all like that. That's not a bad thing. But if you were to ask me if I think that God made a mistake when he made you, I have to say no. He didn't make a mistake. I think one of the kids in my old youth group used to say a long time, God doesn't make junk. I heard that somewhere. God doesn't make junk. He makes us different, but he doesn't make junk. And if God made you, did he make a good thing or a bad thing? Consider the work of God, for who can make that straight which he hath made crooked? Maybe you're not so bad. Verse 14. In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider God also hath set the one over against the other, to the end that man should find nothing after him. Another translation, enjoy prosperity while you can, but when hard times strike, realize that both come from God. That way you will realize that nothing is certain in this life. The bad days aren't all that bad because God uses adversity. He uses tough times to refine us. As I was talking about earlier, that's the lesson of the book of Job, we like to think, we tend to be more like Job's friends, that when we go through tough times, what did I do wrong? There must have been something I did to deserve this. And Job was a righteous man. We just read in the book of Ezekiel where Job's listed in this group of, was it Job and Noah and Daniel? And God's talking to the people and saying, look, I'm going to bring judgment on the land. And even if Noah and Daniel and Job were here, I would still have to bring judgment, you know, because these were righteous guys. Job was a righteous guy. God allowed him to go through adversity as a way of testing and a way of proving to others of who he was. But the adversity wasn't because he was bad. God refined Job. God worked in Job's life. We sang, you know, the song tonight, blessed be your name in the land that is plentiful, when your streams of abundance flow, blessed be your name. But also, blessed be your name when I'm found in the desert place, though I walk through the wilderness, blessed be your name. Every blessing you pour out, I'll turn back to praise. When the darkness closes in, Lord, still I will say, blessed be the name of the Lord. You give and take away, you give and take away. My heart will choose to say, Lord, blessed be your name. Blessed be your name. In the day of prosperity, but in the day of adversity, consider God hath also made one against the other. Verse 15. All things that I have seen in the days of my vanity, there is a just man that perisheth in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man that prolongeth his life in his wickedness. Another translation. In this meaningless life, I have seen everything, including the fact that some good people die young and some wicked people live on and on. Verse 16. Be not righteous over much, neither make thyself overwise. Why shouldest thou destroy thyself? Now, it makes it sound like he's saying, now don't be too goody-good. You can almost sound, in fact, and some of the translations make it sound that way. It makes it sound like, well, now don't overdo this righteousness thing. I think what he's saying is this, because he's talking about the verse we just talked about, that sometimes bad things happen to righteous people, and sometimes good things happen to evil people. That's the truth. That's reality. Sometimes, I don't know where we get this. We get this twisted mindset in the church that if I do good things happen to me. You know, God will bless me. If I do good things, then my life will be without problems. And we get disillusioned, don't we? Because the problems come anyway. The problems still come. God tests us. God refines us. And we're not ready for it. Well, here he's saying, look, don't think that being overly righteous is going to protect you from problems. It's not. You're still going to have difficulties. Verse 17, be not overmuch wicked, neither be thou foolish. Why shouldest thou die before thy time? Well, just because you're not being overly righteous doesn't mean you should be overly wicked either. That's just stupid. Verse 18, it is good that thou shouldest take hold of this. Yea, also from this withdraw not thine hand, for he that feareth God shall come forth of them all. In other words, forget about being overly righteous or overly wicked. The whole point is just fear God, and you'll be where you need to be. Verse 19, wisdom strengtheneth the wise more than 10 mighty men which are in the city. It's better to be wise than to have 10 big burly marines next to you, he's saying. It's better to be wise. Verse 20, for there is not a just man upon earth that doeth good and sinneth not. Everybody sins. There it is, right there in the Old Testament, in good old sarcastic Solomon. Everybody sins. Paul said in Romans 3:23 that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Verse 21, also take no heed unto all words that are spoken, lest thou hear thy servant curse thee. For oftentimes also thine own heart knoweth that thou thyself likewise hast cursed others. In other words, don't be careful about getting so serious about everything that everybody says. You know, sometimes we go just a little bit overboard and overreact to every little thing that everybody says. And he's saying, look, just lighten up a little bit, you know, because if you take everything so seriously, you're going to get in trouble sometimes. Like, I walked into the rest stop bathroom and had barely sat down when I heard a voice from the other stall saying, hi, how are you? Now, I'm not the type to start a conversation in restrooms, at a rest stop, no less, but I answered somewhat embarrassed, doing just fine. And the other guy says, so what are you up to? What kind of a question is that? I'm thinking this is too bizarre. So I say, oh, I'm just traveling like you are. At this point, I'm just trying to get out of there as fast as I can when I hear another question. Can I come over to your place for a while? Well, this question is just plain wacky, so I figured I should be polite, answer him, end the conversation. So I say, well, I have company, so today's a bad day for me. Then I hear the guy say nervously, listen, I'll have to call you back. There's an idiot in the next stall who keeps answering my questions. Bye. You know, sometimes, have you ever said something that you just wish you could take back? Have you ever said that? You ever done something like that? You have, haven't you? You said something and the moment it comes out of your lips, you realize, oh my gosh, I wish I had not said that. Well, you know what? So maybe we ought to be gracious to others who probably have just said something just as stupid and wish they could take it back. That's what he's saying. He's saying, look, don't get so Don't get so over emotional about the things that people say. Sometimes people say stuff that they wish they hadn't. Don't take everything too seriously. Verse 23. All this have I proved by wisdom. I said, I will be wise, but was far from me. That which is far off and exceeding deep, who can find it out? In other words, he's saying the world's just too big for any person to know everything. Even Solomon realized, even the smartest man in the world, realized that there's just too much to find out. Verse 25. I applied mine heart to know and to search and to seek out wisdom and the reason of things and to know the wickedness of folly, even of foolishness and madness, and I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets and her hands as bands. Whoso pleaseth God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken from her. Now he's talking about all the things he's explored and researched and he's saying, boy, worst thing of all is getting caught. And he's saying from his perspective as a man, getting caught by a woman who's manipulating him and using him. And you know, it works both ways, doesn't it? It's not just about women. This is guys and gals. It's terrible to be in a place, in a relationship, where you're caught by somebody. You got suckered into something, and you're being manipulated. He's saying, verse 27, behold, this have I found, saith the preacher, counting one by one to find out the account, which yet my soul seeketh, but I find not. One man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all those have I not found. Now, I'm not sure I want to spend too much time on this. he's saying that he's been searching the world over for people that are righteous. And he's saying that it's so rare that among men, I've only found one among a thousand of men that are righteous. And keep in mind, he just wrote in verse 20, he said, for there's not a just man upon the earth that doeth good and sinneth not. He's already told us that all of us are sinners. And now he's saying there's not even one upright woman that he's ever found. He's talking about with men one among a thousand. I think it's kind of interesting. How many wives did he have? He had 700 wives, 300 concubines. How many is that together? 1,000. 1,000 women he was pretty familiar with. I wonder if it's just a coincidence that this number that he's throwing out. I see a little bit of a bitterness in this man. Wonder if he had done it right and just had one wife and just poured his life into his one wife, if his attitude wouldn't have been a little different. I wonder. The Bible tells us that husbands, we have an effect on our wives. That when we love our wives like Christ loved the church, that our love beautifies her. Christ loved his church by washing his church in the water of his word, removing every spot and wrinkle, getting ready to present us as his bride before his Father, spotless and blameless. Well, that's what happens in a marriage. That ought to be what happens is that a woman gets washed, gets cleansed, gets beautified. But Solomon didn't know that. He didn't experience that. And so he's got a little bit of this bitter taste in his mouth, and I feel bad for him. Because I think he's a little off here. Verse 29. Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. In other words, he's saying this. God designed us humans to be righteous. He designed us to be righteous. But the problem is, we get everything all goofed up. And we sin. And we ruin it all. He designed us, though. We function best I have an electric drill at home. It has a little battery thing, and you charge up the battery, you stick it in the back of the thing, and I can drill holes everywhere, I can screw in screws and stuff. But if I have a nail to pound in somewhere, I don't use the electric drill. I could. But I'd probably end up breaking the thing, you know. It's good to use a hammer because that's what a hammer is designed for. God designed us for righteousness. He designed us to do the right things. And yet sometimes we end up going and doing the stupid things and, end up breaking the drill, and we wonder why is my life all goofed up? Well, because I'm not doing what I was designed to do. Chapter 8, verse 1. Conduct with kings. Who is as the wise man? And who knoweth the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom maketh his face to shine, and the boldness of his face shall be changed. What he's saying is that a wise man knows how to size up a situation and how to conduct himself appropriately. And Solomon is now going to give some instruction about how a wise man conducts himself with the king or with his boss. This is how a wise man conducts himself with his boss. I counsel thee to keep the king's commandment, and that in regard in the oath of God. Now the translation, obey the king because you have vowed before God to do this. Obey your boss, he's saying. Verse 3, be not hasty to go out of his sight. Stand not in an evil thing, for he doeth whatsoever pleaseth him. And the translation, don't try to avoid doing your duty, and don't take a stand with those who plot evil, for the king will punish those who disobey him. Another Proverbs 24:21. We did this a couple weeks back. My child, fear the Lord and the king, and don't associate with rebels, for you will go down with them to sudden disaster. Who knows where the punishment from the Lord and the king will end. Verse 4. Where the word of the king of a king is, there is power, and who may say unto him, what doest thou? Whoso keepeth the commandment shall feel no evil thing. And a wise man's heart discerneth both time and judgment. In other words, we ought to respect those in authority. Look at Romans chapter 13. Romans chapter 13. Romans 13, verse 1. Paul writes this. Paul says, let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God. Whosoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that resist shall receive to themselves damnation. For rulers are not a terror to good works, but to evil. You don't need to be afraid of the government if you're doing what's right. I mean, most of the time, you don't. I mean, some people cook up these cockamamie ideas and stuff, but you know what? Really, you don't need to be afraid of when the policeman drives by you. If you're doing the speed limit, right? And yet when you see that little red cherry on the car behind you in your rear view mirror, don't you kind of like panic? And you go, oh my gosh, well, how fast am I going? What's the speed? I don't know what the speed limit is, you know. But he's saying you don't need to be afraid if you're doing what's right. Wilt thou then not be afraid of the power? Do that which is good, and thou shalt have praise of the same. For he is the minister of God to thee for good. But if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger, to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil. In other words, God gives government the authority to punish. The power of the sword, the ability to punish. Verse 5, wherefore ye must needs be subject not only for wrath, but also for conscience sake. And so God appoints governments. He gives them the authority to enforce the law. And that's what Solomon is saying, is obey the king. Do what the king says. Do what your boss says. Verse 6. Back to Ecclesiastes 8, verse 6. Because to every purpose there is time and judgment. Therefore the misery of man is great upon him, for he knoweth not that which shall be, for who can tell him when it shall be? Now the translation, yes, there is a time and a way for everything, even as people's troubles lie heavily upon them. Indeed, how can people avoid what they don't know is going to happen? Verse 8. There is no man that hath power over the spirit to retain the spirit. Neither hath he power in the day of death, and there is no discharge in that war. Neither shall wickedness deliver those that are given to it. Now, the word that's translated spirit in King James is the word ruach, the Hebrew word ruach. It means spirit or breath or wind. And so some translations say nobody can hold on to the wind. And because just like nobody can hold on to the wind, nobody can keep their own spirit from getting away. You can't control, you know, in the movies, they do all those things, don't they, where the hero has, you know, been riddled with 300 bullets, and he wills himself to crawl up the steps and to take the last key and to stick it in the thing and then shut the machine down and we're all safe and he gives his last. You know what? Psalmist says, that's a bunch of baloney. Nobody wills them. When it's time to die, you die. You can't say, wait, I will not die. But you can't do that. You can't do that. Nobody can will themselves to stay alive. Verse 9, all this I have seen and applied my heart unto every work that is done under the sun. There is a time wherein one man ruleth over another to his own hurt. In other words, I've seen people hurting each other. Verse 10, and so I saw the wicked buried who had come and gone from the place of the holy, and they were forgotten in the city where they had so done. This is also vanity. Now, some of the other translations have a little bit different idea, and the idea is this. It's almost like he went to a funeral one day. He saw a really wicked guy. I mean, Joe the gangster. They were burying Joe the gangster, and he remembered watching the guy even go into the temple and like pretend to be holy. And it says here, King James says he was forgotten. The other translations say he was praised. And you've probably been at funerals like that where you've heard somebody, they give the oh, this was the most wonderful person. You're thinking, he was a wonderful person? Man, he guy made me so mad in life. You know, I hated this guy, you know. And yet, he's saying, this is stupid. This is a vanity. Verse 11. Because sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. When people get away with wickedness, it encourages more wickedness. And just like the person who was wicked and died, and then everybody praised the guy. These are the things that encourage people to do more evil. Verse 12, though a sinner do evil 100 times and his days be prolonged, yet surely I know that it shall be well with them that fear God, which fear before him. So even though sinners get away with it, even though wicked criminals get away with stuff, you're still better off learning to fear God. Verse 13, but it shall not be well with the wicked, neither shall he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he feareth not before God. There is a vanity which is done upon the earth. Here's the thing, it's a waste. That there be just men unto whom it happeneth according to the work of the wicked. Again, there be wicked men to whom it happeneth according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. In other words, he's seen in his lifetime, to be honest, to be perfectly honest. You know, we've got this idea that good things only happen to good people and bad things only happen to bad people. But he's saying, you know, I got to be honest with you. I've seen some good people and some pretty wicked stuff happen to them. And I've seen some wicked people and I can't believe they won the lottery, you know, or whatever, you know. And that's life, isn't it? Isn't it true that life isn't fair? It is. It's true. I know with our kids, you know, we've got three kids, and so when you get, you know, $20 worth of Christmas presents for one, you've got to make sure you have $20 of Christmas presents for the other two, you know, because everybody counts pennies, and once they've got to make everything match and everything exact and everything the same and everything fair. But sometimes I wonder if we don't almost not prepare our kids for the real life, which is life isn't fair. That's the fallen world we live in. Life isn't fair. Verse 15. When I commended mercy, don't you just love this joyful book? Isn't this just wonderful? Don't you just love hearing that? Don't you want him to say, wait a second, you know, just say these three magic words and your life will be wonderful! Yippee! But this is the old cranky guy at the end of his life just being honest and being real and saying, you know what? I've seen so much in life. You know, sometimes life just isn't fair. Verse 15. Then I commended mirth, because a man hath no better thing under the sun than to eat and to drink and to be merry. For that shall abide with him of his labor the days of his life, which God giveth him under the sun. And we talked about this for the last couple of weeks. This has been one of his themes through the book. This is not what we call hedonism. This is not, you know, let's party hardy till we die. That's not it. That's not what he's saying. What he's saying is that it is a gift of God that we learn to enjoy our life. That's the whole point, is to learn to enjoy your life. Sometimes, and I'm sorry to say, sad to report, sometimes as Christians, we get this idea that we better not ever enjoy anything. You know, because we are sinners, and you know, our life should stink, you know, and we should just grit our teeth and grit through life, you know. You know what? God would much rather that you learn to enjoy what he's given you. He's going to say this a couple more times tonight. You know, he wants you so much to learn to enjoy. Paul says in 1 Timothy 6:17, he says, instruct those who are rich in this present world not to be conceited or to fix their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God. Put your hope on God, who richly supplies us with all things to enjoy. God gives us all things to enjoy. And so again, he throws this little thing in. I think we ought to learn to enjoy life, he says, verse 16. When I applied mine heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done upon the earth, for also there is that neither day nor night seeth sleep with his eyes, then I beheld all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun, because though a man labor to seek it out, yet he shall not find it. Yea, farther, though a man think to know it, yet shall he not be able to find it. In other words, God's just so much bigger than me. I have been trying to figure him out, and he's just too big. That's good. That's a good thing. Aren't you glad that God's bigger than you? Yeah? I mean, aren't you? You know, that's a difficulty that the skeptics have a hard time with, that God could actually be bigger than them, actually not fit their little neat little box. He is much bigger. He's much, much bigger than us. Chapter 9. Verse 1, for all this I considered in my heart, even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. No man knoweth either love or hatred by all that is before them. When you consider that bad things happen to good people, and good things happen to bad people, you can't really predict what kinds of things are going to come your way, whether you are good or bad. That's what he's saying. He said, when I look back and realize that good stuff happens to bad people and bad stuff happens to good people, and it's not just that, too. I mean, good stuff happens to good people, too, and bad stuff happens to bad people, too. What he's trying to say is you really can't quite predict what's going to happen in a person's life, can you? Life isn't quite that easy. Verse 2, all things come alike to all. There's one event to the righteous and to the wicked and to the good and to the clean and to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth, to him that sacrificeth not. As is it the good, so is the sinner, and he that sweareth is he that feareth an oath. There is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all. Yea, all also the hearts of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after that they go to the dead. He's saying there's one thing that's common to everybody, whether you're good or bad, nice or naughty, whether you sacrifice to God or don't sacrifice, one thing is common: death. We will all die. Good things, same things happen to good people and to bad. Jesus said in Matthew 5:45, he said that ye may be children of your Father which is in heaven, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth rain on the just and on the unjust. God, the same kinds of things happen to good and bad people. And one thing is common to all, everybody dies. Verse 4, for to him that is joined to all the living there is hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. Now, to a Jew, a dog is the lowest of creatures. The dogs were at the very bottom of the food chain, or the very bottom of the of animals. The lion is the king of the beasts. They're the most revered of the animals, the lions were. But he's saying it's better to be a dog that's living than to be a lion that's dead. Here's a quote from a great theologian, Woody Allen. Someone asked me if my dream was to live on in the hearts of people. I said, I would prefer to live on in my apartment. You drop dead one day and it means less than nothing if billions of people are singing your praises every day, all day long. True. Well, true. And Solomon's saying the same thing. He's saying, look, in this life, it's a little better if you're alive. He's trying to say, verse 5, for the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. Neither have they any more a reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Also their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun. Now, when he's talking about being dead, he's not talking theologically. He's not talking, some people will say, well, he's talking about soul sleep, and we just cease to exist when you die. That's not what he's talking about. He's simply stating the fact that a dead person no longer enjoys the benefits of the world we now live in. That's all he's saying. That's all he's saying. Life is better than death in some aspects. Paul says it in this way, Philippians 1:19, he says, for I know that as you pray for me, and as the Spirit of Jesus Christ helps me, this will all turn out for my deliverance, for I live in eager expectation and hope that I will never do anything that causes me shame, but that I will always be bold for Christ as I have been in the past, and that my life will always honor Christ, whether I live or die. For to me, living is for Christ, and dying is even better. Yet if I live, that means fruitful service for Christ. I really don't know which is better. I'm torn between two desires. Sometimes I want to live, sometimes I long to go and to be with Christ. And that would be far better for me, but it is better for you that I live. And so that's what he's talking about, is that there is some bonuses to being alive. You can do some stuff. You can still do some stuff on this planet while you're alive. That's all that Solomon's trying to say, verse 7. So he says this, going back to his big theme. So go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, and drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. Let thy garments be always white, and let thy head lack no ointment. Another translation. So go ahead, eat your food and drink your wine with a happy heart, for God approves of this. Wear fine clothes with a dash of cologne, he says. You know, it's good to spend time at funerals, wises you up, but don't dress for funerals the rest of your life. You know, dress for a wedding. You know, dress for a party. Enjoy life, verse 9. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of the life of thy vanity, which he hath given thee under the sun. All the days of thy vanity, for that is thy portion in this life and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. Enjoy your marriage. Solomon wrote in Proverbs 18:22, whoso findeth a wife findeth a good thing and obtaineth favor of the Lord. So just enjoy your sweetheart. Enjoy your husband. Enjoy your wife. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. So if you've got something to do, do it with gusto. Live life to the fullest. Do everything with 100%, because when you die, you can't finish it. You can't do that. Now, that's not quite like what the Procrastinator's Creed is. Here's some rules from the Procrastinator's Creed. Number one, I believe that if anything is worth doing, it would have been done already. Or, number two, I shall never move quickly except to avoid more work or to find excuses. Number three, I will never rush into a job without a lifetime of consideration. Or, if at first I don't succeed, there's always next year. Number five, I shall always decide not to decide, unless, of course, I decide to change my mind. How about, I know that the work cycle is not plan, start, finish, but is wait, plan, plan. Sorry, I like that one. Or, I will never put off until tomorrow what I can forget about forever. Okay, I found a better thing. Here's a quote from Thomas Edison. Opportunity is missed by most people because it is dressed in overalls and looks like work. How's that? I like that. Opportunity is missed by most people because it is dressed in overalls and looks like work. So, live life to the fullest. Work with everything you got. Verse 11. I returned and saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to the men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happeneth to them all. For man also knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men snared in an evil time, when it falleth suddenly upon them. Again, just more realistic stuff from an old guy. And he's saying, you know what, frankly, the fastest guy doesn't always win the race. The smartest guy doesn't always get the promotion. Because, you know, sometimes stuff happens. You know, last summer at the Olympics, remember the big thing, one of the things was the marathon. The guy that was leading the marathon was coming into the stadium and some kook crackpot jumped out of the crowd, remember that, and tackled the guy. And the guy ended up coming in third. And they said that, well, there's nothing they could do about it. You know? Does that seem fair? Well, that's life. That's what Solomon's saying. Look, the race is not always to the swift. The fastest guy doesn't always win. So don't be surprised when stuff happens, because it just does. It just does. Verse 13. This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemeth great unto me. There was a little city and a few men within it, and there came a great king against it and besieged it and built great bulwarks against it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city, yet no man remembered the same poor man. So he remembers a story about this one time. This great big king and his army comes and attacks the city, and this one poor guy, but he's wise, figured out a way, negotiated the way out. But afterwards, nobody like even thanked the guy afterwards. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. So don't just think that because you're doing the right thing, that everybody's going to thank you. That may not happen. Verse 17, the words of wise men are heard in quiet, more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. So a wise person can accomplish a lot of things, yet the truth is that sometimes one stupid person ruins everybody's day. There's examples in the scripture. You know, Achan ruined it for Joshua and the children of Israel. They're coming into the promised land, and Achan broke the rules and got the whole nation into trouble. David's sin brought great trouble into Israel. Warren Wiersbe writes this, and this is what we'll end with. Since death is unavoidable and life is unpredictable, the only course we can safely take is to yield ourselves into the hands of God and walk by faith in His Word. We don't live by explanations, we live by promises. We don't depend on luck, but on providential working of our loving Father as we trust His promises and obey His will. As we walk by faith, we need not fear our last enemy, because Jesus Christ has conquered death. Fear not, I am the first and the last. I am he that liveth and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore. Revelation 1. Because he is alive and we live in him, we don't look at life and say, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Instead, we echo the confidence expressed by the Apostle Paul. But thanks be to God who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Let's stand and pray.